13th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
I'm Toby Chad.
The IPL may be over, but there's still plenty of glitz and glamour to be found here.
If a little delayed, sorry to have been off your airways for the last month and a little bit.
I know
we've
many
had
of you
logistical
have been crying
problems
yourselves to sleep
whilst the world cricket has been marching on imperiously with all kinds of interesting developments. We've been doing other things really.
Well, Toby's been jet setting, haven't
I've
you?
I've been jet setting. I've been to China for a while.
Where there wasn't much cricket.
And
that's
I promised us a report on the.
I did.
I could get onto Facebook, but I couldn't get onto Crick Info, which I thought
Facebook
was
yes, Crick Info,
Crick Info no.
No. That is interesting. So the Chinese clearly see some
fermenting rebellion on the. Anyway,
well, one thing while we have been away from our, you know, from the airwaves, our fantasy cricket teams have been floundering to different degrees.
It's quite.
I think let's get the stats out there, Toby. Do you want to give us the positions?
Look at the Lee, give me two seconds.
Well, look, to summarise, I've got a minor lead at this stage.
The Jesus Green second 11, which is Mr. Ryan's team. Are in position 7,316, and I don't mean to laugh because my own side are in position 15,636.
Right,
and
we were
hypothesising earlier how many members there are, and they're probably 15,637.
We're hoping there's quite a lot. I mean, I'm currently an 8,000 place lead. I'd like to think is something that I can brag about.
But
surely.
when I left the country and left my players to their own devices and desires, all kinds of bad things happen. Because the thing about playing fantasy cricket is you have to keep your eye on the ball, and not only did I not realise that two of my players, Carberry and Tomlinson, both at Hampshire, hadn't been playing at all and had no prospect of playing for several months.
I'm sorry, that's poor
research. I also suffered from a Twitter outburst from Tsotsobe at
Tsotsobe has been promptly sent home.
Well, exactly. Having said it, it had been the most miserable 2 weeks of his life. So, altogether, I haven't been. I wasn't entirely successful in my first picks, and then having not had the opportunity to change them after that.
It does require being sort of relentlessly on the ball. I mean, my team's success story has all been about Rory Hamilton-Brown, who, particularly when Surrey went to Whitgift and the lovely small boundaries of Whitgift, helped himself to an awful lot of runs,
and
scored a lot of runs.
Has he been your captain as well, as he has been at
Rather unfortunately, he hasn't been my captain. I went for a gamble with my captain, if you might remember. I went for Adil Rashid. I like the idea of having faith in a young British leg spinner, young English leg spinner. And, you know, he's actually not done that badly, but I'm not very positive about him at the moment. He went to Hove the other week and took naught for 180
odd. And the bad thing about the Telegraph Fantasy League is they double your negative points
so Rashid actually made a negative contribution to my team,
which probably wiped out all the, because he had been actually playing quite well.
He's had a couple of good games. I mean, basically he probably doesn't make enough runs for an all-rounder in the game. He's been averaging 20 odd this year. He's been taking a lot of wickets, so we may well see a change there. Who've been the rare stars in your otherwise floundering
I picked Chimin Devas as one of my bowlers, and he is actually top of the bowler rankings according to the Telegraph. And actually, as a sort of footnote, we're yet to work out quite how the Telegraph work out their rankings. Mm. But Chimin Devas has been part of a Northants side which has looked pretty. I mean, very strong indeed. He took a 7-wicket haul against Glamorgan.
Well, they were supposed.
But Northants has been all conquering. Have they yet lost?
They haven't lost. And this week saw what was supposed to be the table-topping clash in Division Two, Northants Glamorgan. And it turned into a rather pathetic rout, as they won
pathetic
by
rant,
an
I think
innings.
That's what we're doing now,
that's
actually.
Doing, yeah. an innings and 170-odd runs. And it's interesting because Northants, I mean, even if you make allowances for the fact that Division 2 is a lower level, the Northants team looks quite workmanlike, looks quite unspectacular. And they've just been so consistent.
They have,
an awful
and they're
lot
going
of
to
runs.
Be having... I think just announced Johan Botha is going to be joining them from South Africa for the 2020s.
Well, another South African, Andrew Hall, who's someone we haven't thought about for a while, scoring a lot of runs for them from learning
the order. He played in that great series in 2004, wasn't it, when Graham Smith made all those runs in the first Test of England. I mean, so he is certainly
and
not.
He's
hasn't been an international
there,
reckoning
but
for a while.
Shaminda Vass, I think you made the point when you picked him. He's frankly far too good a bowler for that level. And
even despite the fact that he's getting on a bit, his kind of wiliness is proving a bit too much.
Well, several journalists made the point Sri Lanka could probably do with him today.
You had James Harris, didn't you?
James Harris has been fantastic.
The other end of their career.
The extraordinary thing about James Harris is he's missed a couple of games with an ankle injury and is still my second highest point scorer. The point about Harris, I think, is all the stories have really been about him as a young pace bowler with the ability to extract bounce from most surfaces, the ability to swing the ball, and that's incredibly exciting in itself. The real story for my fantasy team is that he scores an awful lot of lower order runs as well. And actually, he seems to be making a very strong case to be included as an all-rounder. Such is the situation of the England, the strength, I suppose, of the England bowling setup, that I don't think he's really getting a mention there. And perhaps that's a good thing. He's still young.
How old is he now?
I'm going to say he's 19 or 20. We're going to say 20, but that's slightly guessing. Yeah. I think he's only 20.
But with a strong disclaimer that we're not.
But in terms of, who have been, who's particularly upset you?
Well, James Hildreth has particularly upset me. I've been a Somerset fan for a long time, and so Somerset in general have been upsetting me, even though they seem to have kind of stabilised and stopped making disastrous losses as they did at the very beginning of the series. But James Hildreth, I think he's top scored at something like 54, which for a man who last season just couldn't stop scoring centuries is odd, and I think there's something slightly odd going on at Somerset at the moment. They seem to have taken a long time to sort of get into the season, to get used to the idea of being favourites.
Somerset, perhaps that is it, the pressure of being favourites, because they were for many people the default favourites, weren't they? They looked such a strong team in so many departments. I mean, for Hildreth, we'll get onto it in a moment, the issues over maybe a spot opening up in the England side. He is of an age where he really would need to make his case, wouldn't he?
That's very interesting, yeah. And he has been associated with the England set up for sort of 3 or 4 years, and he's been playing for the Lions for a while as well.
I think he captained the Lions against Sri Lanka, actually.
Yes, he did. No, you're absolutely right. It's an interesting dynamic in the side, because I don't think, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, I don't think there are actually any current England players.
But
what you've got is you've got Trescothick, who's obviously an ex-England player. You've got Keyes-Vesser and Hildreth, who are in varying degrees potential current England players.
Yeah.
And so there's quite an interesting dynamic within the side that how they relate to
They benefited from English oversight.
Yeah.
For me, Ravi Bapara, this is a slightly harsh one because he hasn't done too badly. But there have been a string of low scores recently, and it's interesting in relation to his own problems with the England set. I mean, Bapara seemed to do everything right. He turned down the IPL. He went to County Cricket, scored a lot of runs at the start of the season.
Started bowling pretty well.
And took wickets as well. And then he's found himself, Owen Morgan's been picked ahead of him. And you do just wonder, it'll be fascinating to see the response from him.
There was very interesting, in the England Lions game against Sri Lanka, when both Morgan and Bapara was playing. Well, I think it was on the morning of the last day it was announced that Morgan was in the Test squad and Bapara wasn't. And then they both went out to bat, and Bapara went out to bat first, and you thought, right, he's gonna prove the selectors wrong and go out and score a dashing 100 and save it for the Lions. And he went out and failed. And then Morgan went out, and you thought, oh, Morgan's going to go out and he's going to show why he was selected for England and go out and make a good score. And he went out and failed as well. Bapara is in an interesting position.
I mean, a lot of the top batsmen, top bowlers as well, they're defined by that battle for an England place, and it will be very interesting to see how they respond. But at any rate, we're enjoying our experience of the Daily Telegraph County Cricket Challenge, and we hope to be able to report more success. There's a bit of a break now with the 2020s, but moving from county to the international arena, we had, I think, Monday's day of Test cricket at Cardiff rates as an extraordinary
day as I've ever had the pleasure to
I was listening to it. It was extraordinary.
I don't think,
Explain it, Toby.
Well, I don't think that England expected it. I know that when we were talking last night, you said that you thought perhaps England did, and England showed a bit of gumption by putting Sri Lanka in and saying we're going to have a bowl at you. But, I mean, I actually think it is just one of those freakish things that just happens. And I think, actually, that the Sri Lankan batting lineup is pretty strong.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, Prasanna, Jayawardena obviously batted quite well in the... first innings. They've got the big three, the Sangakkara, Mahela Jayawardena and Dilshan as well. And I thought Pranav Vatana looked very, or however we pronounce his name, looked very good in the first inning. And I do honestly think that it was just one of those freakish sessions where...
I agree with you up to a point. I just think that there was something impressive for me about the way England went about it. I mean, I found it very interesting. The commentators from the start on TMS, the guys on the BBC Live Text, were all very clear. It was really seen as a fairly irrelevant little session. It was quite funny. They had Graham Swann on today on TMS, yeah, saying how he had spoken to Andrew Strauss, saying that this was going to be the most boring session of cricket for a while. And obviously, a good England bowling performance in itself wasn't enough, but they went out, and Chris Tremlett in particular, bowled with an intensity that they were serious about making something happen.
They were. What worries me slightly is that England, having bowled out the Sri Lankan side, pretty good batting side, with just three bowlers, that England are going to take this as a ringing endorsement of their four-bowler policy, four-bowler plus Jonathan Trott policy. But it was absolutely bizarre in the first innings.
I think some would argue four bowlers minus Jonathan Trott.
Well, in the first innings, how... I think something of the 96 overs in the Sri Lankan first innings, only 12 were bowled by Graham Swann, the fourth man in the attack, and more had been bowled by Jonathan Trott by that point. And it seems an extraordinary way to go about it. But I do think England are going to suffer if they do persist in a four-man attack
series
against India, particularly.
Exactly. If you look at this in relation to the team we'll pick for India, and against that strength of a batting lineup, I think it is a difficulty. I mean, it comes down to basically an attitude of caution, really, doesn't it? It comes down to a belief that you need those extra batsmen in case other batsmen fail.
And there's this argument as well, which is that, you know, the bowlers should be able to do their job, so you only need four of them if they're going to be able to do their job. But the same surely applies exactly to the batsmen, and you shouldn't, exactly as you say, you shouldn't be always going for the safe option and having extra
batsmen. I wonder
extra
how much of it comes down to Matt Prior in a way. I think there's actually quite a strong sense that he's a bit of a sort of dasher with the bat, can score runs quickly, but I think there's actually he's made that spot his own. I don't think there's any real contention over the wicketkeeper spot, but I do think there's some... I think there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable perhaps with giving him the number six position. I mean, what do you reckon?
Hence why you have to play an extra batsman as opposed to... But the thing that's... England not having, obviously, the whole problem has been created by not having an Andrew Flintoff type figure, who wasn't a great batsman, actually, and was in the team more on the strength of his bowling than he was on the strength of his batting, if you look at both together. But what I think is interesting is that Owen Morgan isn't necessarily a hugely better batsman than Ravi Bapara. Ravi Bapara, his international reputation has been stained by that horrible series against the Australians when he couldn't buy a run.
Which is a tough way to come.
I just really think the problem with this four-man attack or a three-man pace attack is that when Strauss had to use Jonathan Trott, it let off a huge amount of the pressure that England had put on Sri Lanka, because he leaked runs. And yes, he can hold an end up, in inverted commas, and go for four and over while a bowler recovers.
I mean, it became the cliche of that of the first test, really, of those first few days, how much England missed Collingwood. And they missed him not for the reasons that we might expect of gutsy batting, but, you know, Cook put down a couple of tough chances that we would expect Collingwood to hold. And what we realised, I think, is that we never looked to Collingwood's bowling for real breakthroughs.
No.
Simply
it's
to
a supporting act. It's a complete
just
supporting
act. Just to keep the economy rate down, to take a bowler off and give him some. So it is a problem that England are yet to address. I mean, I think it will be very interesting. It will say a lot about England's state of mind, how many bowlers they go in with against India, because it will show a real confidence, I think, if they pick another bowler.
Well, it's like, for instance, in the last Test of the 2005 Ashes when Collingwood was picked as a replacement for Simon Jones, and that was seen as a kind of very defensive thing in England playing for the draw, having already got the lead. But but how do you see looking in the shorter term before the India series? How do you see this series panning out? Do you think the Sri Lankans are going to come back strongly? I mean, they haven't today. We're talking at the
well.
End of the
I mean, it's interesting. I was initially very optimistic about this series. I thought this was a very strong Sri Lankan team. Actually, a stronger Sri Lankan team than maybe people were giving them credit for. And obviously, the first test and the way they lost in that, I thought they would struggle to respond. I actually don't think today's been a disastrous day for them. They've wasted a good start having had England at 22 for 3. But really, if this test is going to come down to a contest, it's going to be a contest, it is all about whether the Sri Lankan bowlers could take major England wickets.
Yep,
and
exactly.
To be fair to them, they did that today. They took Trott cheaply, which almost felt like a historic event. Jonathan Trott giving his wicket away almost, playing across the line. But I think if the Sri Lankan bowlers take wickets and keep England to reasonable scores, we will get a contest. I've no doubt Sri Lanka will make runs. I think my fear after the first test was that England would stack up 650 declaration scores ease against a
exactly. And what is quite interesting about England having selected Finn is that they do now have a very one-dimensional bowling attack, and actually at Lords, on what is from what I've been listening to today, a very good batting pitch, not having the variety that having Anderson or as his replacement Shahzad or Onions or Jay Dernbach, indeed, although I've never actually seen him play.
It's from interesting. What I've heard of him, Finn for Anderson is not a like-for-like replacement.
No,
I mean, Shahzad, for all his inexperience, makes more sense as a like-for-like replacement. He's much more about sort of canny swing bowling.
And what's interesting as well is that they the Sri Lankan batsmen are used to pretty pacey wickets.
Yeah.
And that actually being able to field the tallest attack in history, or whatever the England PR team are claiming this is, isn't necessarily the greatest
said, I mean, they really, really struggled to deal with Tremlett at Cardiff. I mean, I think it'll be very interesting to see how this pans out, because again, although this is a series in itself, we've got to look at everything in context of the India series next. I mean, if this three-man, you know, particularly if Finn goes well, these bowlers have got a real chance to establish themselves as the sort of choice for that India series.
So England are now 1-0 up after that win in Cardiff. What do you think the final score?
I can't see Sri Lanka winning a test.
No.
So I think we're looking at 2-0. I mean, you can see them getting enough runs to get away with a draw from one of them. I mean, I agree.
I just don't think their bowlers are strong enough to win.
No, I mean, I thought the whole the best thing England could get out of this series, and the thing they had to avoid actually as well, was that sort of post-Ashes win complacency.
Yep.
If England are serious about being a world number one side, they had to dispatch the Sri Lankan team, and actually, courtesy of those rather bizarre events at Cardiff, they are in a position to do that now quite comfortably. I thought, if anything, we actually saw the first signs of complacency this morning, actually.
Yep.
I wondered
yep.
if those English batsmen didn't expect things to come a little bit easier today. But
as you say, the main feast will come later in the summer.
We look forward to that eagerly.
From the archives, and we've recently seen the retirement of one of the greats of the game, who went out in a bit of a whimper of poker and 2020. It is, of course, the great Shane Warne. But we're going to rewind to the beginning of his career, which was not much more illustrious, actually.
It's interesting for a player that went on to become such a force in the game. He entered, you know, quite...
He took a while. Took a while to get going.
Stop and start.
Took a while to get going.
Yeah.
And the very match which we're going to look at is his fifth test, a test against the West Indies at the MCG in 1992. And it was the first match when he really announced himself onto the scene. Up till then, he'd been pitched onto the test scene at the age of 23, and had sort of failed to live up to his billing as the sort of the new prodigy. He was part of an Australian side which was very much rebuilding. They'd just won series against India at home and Sri Lanka away, but now they came up to the series against the great West, well, the remnants of the great
West
Indian side.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got these two teams that meet with the Australians rebuilding, and we know with the benefits of the hindsight, the Australian side on the way to becoming something very, very special, and a West Indian side that, having dominated certainly the mid to late 70s and the 80s,
You can almost feel the baton being passed on.
It's almost just at the cusp, isn't it? The West Indies are perhaps, you know, we wouldn't perhaps have been aware of this at the time, but were on the way down. The Aussies are certainly on the way up.
But having said that, in the 1980s, the West Indies won 12 matches against Australia, and Australia won only three in return. So it was very much...
I mean, that's a staggering margin of
dominance,
really.
And when you look at the side playing in this match at the MCG, you've got Ambrose and Walsh, Jimmy Adams, Lara Richardson, Carl Hooper, Ian Bishop, Desmond Haynes. I mean, it is a fantastic side. So, I mean, I think it's going to be overstating it to say that Australia were playing against a kind of dying West Indian side.
There was still an awful lot of strength in that side.
It's interesting that actually in the first test of the series, Australia have the chance to land a killer blow against the West Indies, but Warn isn't playing. Greg Matthews is playing as a spinner in his place, and I defy you to be able to tell me off the top of my head Greg Matthews' test bowling average. You're not allowed to look it up. Greg Matthews fails to finish the West Indies off after the West Indies are 9 for 4, chasing 231. They hang on and 133 for 8 at the close. So that's the first test of this series. The selectors drop Greg Matthews and they bring in Warne, looking for a killer edge to try and finish this West Indies period of dominance.
It's a very engaging test match from the start. I mean, the Aussies find themselves in trouble early on at 115 for 4. And it's Ambrose and Walsh. I mean, a young Ambrose and Walsh. It's funny because people who've watched, when I watch them, they're eternally old in my head. I always watch them at that end of my career.
Very much.
A youthful Ambrose and Walsh.
That end of their career rather than your watching career.
And they were fantastic then, even at the end. And they'd taken a pair of wickets each. And, I mean, the fact that it took Mark Taylor sort of 76 balls to get to 30 sums up sort of a tricky morning for the Aussies. So you have them 115 for 4, and Alan Border joins Mark Waugh out at the crease. Big series for Alan Border.
That's the kind of partnership to make your
It's an interesting
water.
One, isn't it? You've got Border, who by this stage is 37 and knows it must be his last chance as captain against the West Indies. And you've got Mark Waugh coming out of the worst run in his entire career. He finished the Sri Lanka series with 4 consecutive ducks.
The
preceding series. So two batsmen in sort of interesting positions, but they lead the fight back impressively. They put on a 204-run partnership, both make hundreds. And the Aussies in the end get to a pretty respectable 395. And it's obviously wrong to see kind of aggressive pace bowling as a purely West Indian thing, because Merv Hughes gets the Aussies off to a very good start in response. The Windies are down to 33 for 3. He's taken all 3 of them. Lara and Arthurton then rebuild, both make half centuries. But actually, for a Windies team with a lot of really great names in them, no one really makes a big score. And in the end, and the tail is a fairly long one, and they only managed 233.
Jimmy Adams batting at 7.
The tail contributes relatively little. And the Australians are left with a massive 162-run lead. And actually, having been in a position in the first test where they should have won that, they find themselves another. From the first innings, Shane Warne does actually very little. He sends down 24 overs, but only picks up the wicket of Ambrose, which, for all the things you can say about Curtly Ambrose, that's, his wicket was not perhaps the most prized.
Not flattering Warne there.
So Warne, there's no real sign in that first innings that Warne's going to do anything.
What's interesting is that actually the vast majority of the bowlers in this match go for under three and over. It's a yeah, it's a pretty
slow,
intense affair.
Well, it's funny, though, because I think maybe that's even just a change in era from the present. Like, yep. we would now see that as great economy rates, but even at the time, maybe that wasn't quite the economy rate.
So, Australia have got 160 lead.
They're in a great position, and really, they should bat themselves out of sight, but they waste the opportunity, and when Border falls, they're actually 102 for 6, and the West Indies are in the kind of position where they can give themselves a tough target, but a chaseable target. A young Damian Martin, who's playing only his second test, makes a patient 67, and he gets the Australians up to 196. Not a great score, but
not
it's
as
a lead
many as they'd like against this batting lineup.
Well, really, they should have batted themselves. You know, they should have killed it as a contest. But they've given the West Indies 359 to chase, and no side's ever scored this many to win at Melbourne. So it's, you know, it's a big chase.
And then comes the moment.
Well, yes. Well, we took a bit of a while to get to the moment, but Haynes goes early, but Simmons and Richardson settle in very well. Both make 50s, and but at the stage. The West Indies get to 143 for 1, and at this stage the chase looks on, doesn't it?
The nerves must have been jangling in the Australian camp.
And you know that there is a lot of batting in that West Indies. You know, we've got Lara to come in next. There's an awful lot of batting there, and at that stage, you know, getting another 200 probably looks very, very doable. And yeah, here comes Prodigy Warne.
Yep.
He picks up Richardson, the West Indian captain at the time, with the top spinner just before lunch. And pretty soon, we've got the sort of carnage that Warne was to unleash so often in his career. Arthurton, Hooper, Simmons all go. By the time Simmons falls, it's really over as a contest.
And Lara as well, he gets for a cheap 4.
And
Warne, oh, no, sorry, that wasn't Warne, was it? That was
who picks up Lara?
That was Whitney.
Okay. So there are other contributions there, but Warne does by far the majority of the damage.
Yeah.
He then runs through the tail very quickly and finishes with 7 for 52.
From 143 for 2, the West Indies are 219. All out, which is and that's 7 for 52, which is
it's a fairly
even on a fourth and fifth day wicket, it's a pretty spectacular.
It is interesting because obviously Warne hasn't done the damage in the first innings, and these are, you know, some excellent batsmen. So it's interesting that the difficulty they have dealing with his leg spin perhaps says something about the condition of the fifth day pitch. The interesting thing is, though, you know, this was the first flash of the brilliant player Warne was to become. It didn't really mark a long-term change in his fortunes.
No.
I mean, he picked up just 2 wickets in the next 3 tests. I mean,
what's interesting is that the beginning of Warne's career is characterised so much by matches like this, by obviously the gassing ball is the one kind of seminal moment which everyone
goes back to again and again.
And actually, what was so distinctive about his later career is simply how reliably, particularly in Test cricket, how reliably consistent he was in terms of taking wickets, how much of a danger he was consistently. But actually, for the first 3 or 4 years of his career, he was very, very much hit and miss.
Well, Warne's story actually makes a very strong case for sticking with players that you believe to have talent, because, you know, his figures just were not enough to justify,
no,
you know,
exactly.
You wouldn't have expected what came next.
But particularly for a leg spinner, which, as someone who attempts to bowl leg spin myself, when it goes wrong, which it does the entire time, it does go horribly wrong. And it's the most difficult thing to bowl if you're having a bad day. And you see that at the beginning. And actually, what it does is it makes you realise how impressive the rest of his career was, when these kind of good days, these kind of 7-wicket hauls became pretty normal.
It's also an interesting what-if, though, because frankly, if Warne hadn't had that one fantastic day, one fantastic afternoon at the MCG where he took 7, the Australian selectors had shown a ruthlessness. You know, they'd got rid of Matthews when he hadn't worked. Had they got rid of Warne early here, we just don't know how easily he'd have found his way back into the side. I mean, I think that 7-wicket, you know, those 7 wickets bought him time that was later, you know, the Australians were to be very well repaid
exactly.
with.
On to the book review, and this week we're going to be looking at The Best Love Game by Geoffrey Moorhouse. Geoffrey Moorhouse, a man who is certainly not renowned for his cricket writing, and that's mostly because this is the only book he ever wrote on cricket. He was better known as a journalist, as a travel writer, as a social historian. And basically what Moorhouse sets out to do in The Best Loved Game is to capture English cricket as he sees it in 1979.
Eight.
Published in 1979, written in 1978. Difference of opinion. In 1978, as he saw it before Packer burst onto the scene, and as many thought, changed the game forever, as he probably did. And what Moorhouse does is, this is a collection of a dozen or so essays, which are written about different games around the country. He goes to a test match, he goes to some county grounds, he also goes to one or two village games. And so, essentially, it's a kind of compendium of English cricket as it exists before the Packer revolution.
I mean, the book is... I like the fact the book is written with a very clear purpose in mind. It's this attempt to sort of describe the game in its entirety at a time when he really felt it was going to change forever. Yep. He was... You know, he was quite disgusted, really, by the influence, the negative influence he felt that the Packer era was having on the game.
And there is a sense of his kind of old-fashionedness. Although I would rather think of it as a kind of... he prioritises the aesthetic part of the game above anything else. There's an interesting place where he talks about the use of helmets, and he throws his hands up and he says, I know I sound ridiculous for the fact that I dislike helmets, but there is something sort of ignoble about the fact that batsmen have to wear helmets, and there's something wonderful about seeing a batsman nearly getting killed.
I mean, the difficulty I have with it is, you know, cricket is always the traditionalist within cricket. In many ways, I'd count myself as one myself. I think there are a lot of traditions within cricket that, you know, serious fans are desperate to protect. But with Moorhouse, it does occasionally just become a little bit tedious. I mean, I found that helmets rant a little bit exhausting. I think there are innovations in cricket, you know, the DLF maximums, etc., that we can all agree are awful.
Ludicrous.
But, you know, when he spends a page ranting about a helmet, you do feel perhaps I felt the priorities maybe slightly misplaced.
And you felt as well, didn't you, that there was something a little bit bits and piecey about the fact that here was a book which had brought together effectively lots of match reports across the country in order to kind of create a mosaic which Moorhouse claims as a representative.
You see, I would say there is no question of his... I mean, his writing is fantastic, and we'll talk about a little bit later some beautiful moments of punditry and description he offers. I do occasionally feel that the match report format, because, I mean, you described it as a collection of essays. I would really say it's ultimately a collection of well-written match reports. And my feeling is that, in a way, that it can become a bit difficult to read. It can come a bit bitty, particularly with some of the games that are not thrilling games. The match reports maybe are... It's a question of, does it do what he wanted it to do? Does it paint a portrait of English cricket at the time? I think it does. I think painting match reports from different parts of the country is an effective way of doing that. My only concern is when you are reading pages of descriptions of the nuances of a game, who was bowling then, who was batting then, it can sometimes be a little bit difficult to relate when it's a game that doesn't...
So if you're effectively saying that... what he's doing is he's creating a sort of a picture of cricket matches rather than cricket with a capital C at the time. I would argue actually very strongly against that, and I think where he is very clever and actually quite significant here is that as a historian generally he wasn't a Marxist historian, but in a sense he was of that school in terms of seeing history as a more general scheme, as it were. I think what he is very good at is that he does present cricket as quite a homogenous thing, because there are three wonderful chapters in succession at one point where he describes a county game, the Roses match, the Lancashire Yorkshire match, followed by a Test match. I think it's England.
England Pakistan. Yeah.
Followed by a village game in Oxfordshire, in the middle of nowhere. And actually, I think what he does actually very effectively is to show how cricket is in essence the same in all of them. And despite the fact that when you're in the village ground, you have anecdotes about the dog making a sausage on the barbecue. I mean, you don't have that anecdote, I hasten to add.
But it's that kind of stuff.
And the background is very different in the Test matches. That actually the kind of the moments of encounter between a batsman and a bowler, which are at the heart of all cricket, are actually shown to be very much the same wherever you are
in the country. I wonder whether there might not have been more writing on, more reflection perhaps on comparing the relations between the game. Perhaps, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, the writing is consistently of a really high quality. I think perhaps I could have done with less blow-by-blow analysis. I mean, there was one game, the Hambledon versus Brigham's game.
Yeah, I know.
And by this stage, we're reaching the end of the book, and I feel like, you know what, I'm interested in your portrait of cricket, your views on cricket, but the blow-by-blow account of this village game doesn't instantly...
But why... I think that's kind of the point, the fact that he is repeatedly showing you matches which don't matter in any way whatsoever if you're not there. It probably didn't matter to anyone who was there at all. But, I mean, it's this wonderful aesthetic view, well whether wonderful or not, it's an aesthetic view of cricket which says that here is the essence of cricket. It's in this tiny little village match in the middle of nowhere between a batsman and a ball. And no one else cares, and it's maybe not. But in terms of the art of it, and as you say, it's beautiful. Written, and I think he does portray
one thing
some of the
he does better actually than a lot of conventional sports writers is he does talk rather wonderfully about the crowd. I mean, I only really noticed this about halfway through the
book. It's like Henry Bofelt in his pitch.
Well, he says so many of his match reports are focused on like tidbits he hears from the crowd, and it does paint a wonderful portrait. And there is this wonderful sort of he has a really strong sense of the little details that cricket fans love. I mean, his writing as well. For a non-cricket writer, I think he writes about some of the players quite brilliantly. This on David Gower, built like a guardsman, that expressionless face with its black moustache surely saw service in England's old imperial wars, defending Rorke's Drift, marching up the Khyber Pass. Yeah. I mean, brilliant, frankly. Have you read a better description of that arrogance, that sort of sense of entitlement that Gower had when he went out to bat? You know, he perhaps not being a cricket writer, he allows himself to sort of poetry that others do. There's a rather sad description in the way of the Lancashire League game where he talks about Brian Close being run out, thunders past the broken wicket, carries on for several yards, turns and comes in grim-faced as he could be even in his salad days, but now with his chest heaving out of breath. It's rather wonderful. And
wonderful honesty actually about that, isn't there? Because you don't, think about Brian Close's later career being gritty and everything like that, but he's Morehouse is just like he was just a bit unfit, a little bit fat.
And I mean, Matthew Engels in his foreword to it really talks about how perhaps the privileged position Morehouse had was as someone who loved the game but was not. It was not complacent about it. It was not a cricket writer that spent day after day there. I mean, Engels talks about how for a cricket writer, the ground almost becomes your office. Mm. Morehouse still went there with that sort of love of the amateur, and he picks up on these details.
But also
and
a love of the, as kind of a social historian in a lot of his journalism work, a love of people. And you can see that comes through the very human aspects of the game, and he doesn't get bogged down in statistics and things like that.
I think perhaps the value of the book will only grow because he set out to write a record of history at a particular time, and even now looking back on it, he's recording some things that sadly we've lost, sadly have passed, and particularly there's the odd moment where I think, you know, he talks about Botham, and I think he doesn't know at the time quite how significant those descriptions of Botham will be to later fans and later readers. And finally, for the debate. Now, in the last few podcasts, we've kind of looked at an issue of the moment. Today, we're looking at a debate that's, you know, almost an eternal debate, an eternal argument within cricket. Is batting more inherently heroic than bowling? And, I mean, I'm inclined to sort of line up with the batsman on this one.
So you're very much from the old school professional against amateurs. The amateurs go out and bat heroically, nobly, while the professionals sweat away.
The poor bowlers,
bowling,
yeah.
You know, in a kind of workmanlike setup. Is that the basis of it then?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think most cricket fans, without maybe even knowing it, tend to side in a way with batsmen and bowlers. They tend to be the kind of fans.
Which is exactly why I think there is something very noble about bowling. And I remember when I used to think the side of Matthew Hoggard piling in, bowling over
this
after
an
over, usually bowling
teenage
into the wind and uphill. I used to think there was something particularly I was about to say attractive, but I don't think it was attractive. But
choose your words carefully.
So there was something quite heroic about that. Partly it was the fact that there is very little recognition often for bowlers. Also, it's the fact that bowlers are so entirely, where batsmen are masters of their own world. Bowlers are at the whims of their fielders all the time. A bowler requires a good fielding setup.
Right, so
a batsman only requires himself.
So we've
to be
all
on
had
form.
Pity at one time or another for the bowler who's bowled brilliantly and has had several routine chances dropped. I mean, I've always thought one of the things with batting is you so often get, and you feel this actually when you're batting yourself, it's the difference between the nets and the middle.
Yep.
You know, you so often feel that 1 against 11. And I do think there's something quite heroic in that. You've got the batsman lined
absolutely.
Up. You take your guard, you look around, you've got all the fielders there. And it really is you against a team.
It is, but at the same time, the moments of sort of game-changing brilliance never really come for batsman. When a batsman reaches his 100, for instance, that's a kind of a seminal moment.
It's a moment
whereas
of celebration.
Whereas when
he
hits a 6, it's a kind of moment of transition. Only bowlers can have a kind of completely decisive moment. If a batsman hits a 6, he can get out the next ball. If a bowler gets someone out, they're out. And the bowler has won.
I think it's right that bowlers operate in moments, don't they? Like a fantastic spell often comes down to just a couple of moments, whereas a great innings will come down to sort of, you know,
I'm not sure that's entirely true.
Well, it'll be remembered by the great moments.
Well, exactly, but there's a huge difference there, isn't there, between the perception of something and the fact that, you know, that the Matthew Hoggards often are the people who, or as we were discussing earlier, the Paul Collingwoods are sometimes the people who hold the bowling attack together, even though they're the people
who
Well,
the you talk about Collingwood's
enough.
Contribution to the bowling attack. In terms of heroic batting in recent years, Paul Collingwood is very much the definitive article in terms of England. I mean, some of the Test cricket that I've enjoyed most over the last couple of years.
2006 double century against the.
When England were in South Africa, not this winter, but the winter before, and frankly, I thought that South Africa team was better than the England team, man for man. And England came out of that series with a draw, and so much of that down was just a bloody-minded batting. And Collingwood was absolutely key to that. And there was something deeply heroic about that. He set himself up against a very good bowling attack and just said, I'm not going to score many runs, but you just won't get me out.
Well, and there's also something quite safe about bowling, which says not about batting. When you're bowling, you can't really be physically intimidated, apart from if you're bowling against Matthew Hayden, when I think anyone would feel physically intimidated.
I think with Chris Gayle as well.
Chris Gayle's probably too lazy to beat anyone up, but Matthew Hayden will.
Well, I don't know, but just in terms of where the ball would end up, I think if I personally was bowling to Chris Gayle, I would certainly indulge in some protective gear of some variety.
Bowling to Chris Gayle.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the crowd.
I'm sure Chris Gayle would pay for that as well.
But there is something very. I mean, I think you're right. There's something very alone about a batsman, and there's something. I mean, being a batsman and playing badly is incredibly lonely. But if you're a bowler,
and well, actually, maybe if you're a bowler and you're getting hit all over the park, that's a fairly lonely experience.
Even though you've got your teammates. I suppose the other thing that often you often realise when you're playing cricket at a village level is that a bowler who has a bad over will generally get another over. The batsman who has a bad ball, that's his day over. I mean, I'm very interested in this issue on the impact of 2020, because in many ways we've all really seen 2020 as a batting sport. Yeah. I mean, batting form of the game, it's all about the big sixes, the big boundaries. But actually, maybe that dominance of the bat, the sort of the way that Chris Gayle can miss hit someone for six, has actually made the bowlers that bit more heroic. Maybe our sympathy goes out to them a little bit more.
And actually, I think the IPL has begun to reward bowlers who can bowl economically, as opposed to bowlers who can bowl spectacularly, very, very well. I mean, Daniel Vittori is a good case in
point there. Prime example of this.
Which is that he doesn't actually take all that many wickets in 2020, but he does bowl very... I mean, I think his international 2020 economy rate is under 4, which for an off-spinner is...
Very, very impressive. I think maybe it comes down to we just like our cricketers up against the odds and struggling, don't
exactly,
we?
As Geoffrey Morehouse would have put it.
Thank you very much for joining us after a little bit of a break for the 13th episode of Reverse Sort Radio. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, where we'll be talking about how this English Sri Lanka series had panned out and probably many other interesting things.